Welcome to Season 9 of American Political History, Wars Within Wars, Census. In September of 1708, the Carolina Assembly reported to Whitehall the descriptions of its neighboring Indians, as well as a census of the colony and surrounding nations. The population of Carolina was set at 9,580, with several groups of free Indians living around the colonies, perhaps population 1,000. South Carolina's economy was largely dependent on importing English manufacturing goods, including tools, weapons, clothes, and other necessities. Rice had become the most valuable cash crop. Around half the black slaves were involved in rice production, since African slaves had experienced growing rice. South Carolina's second industry was supplying naval commodities like tar, pitch, and turpentine. Tar was made by burning soaked wood of pine trees and collecting the resulting liquid. Pitch was made by boiling tar to a concentrate, and turpentine was made by distilling the sap. Slaves provided the vast majority of labor to make these products. There were four categories of slaves within the colonies. First was the Negro, or black African slave, considered good at agricultural work because they were well-suited for the semi-tropical climate. By 1700, most black slaves were either born as slaves within the colony or imported slaves from the Caribbean. First-generation African slaves were much less valuable. They had to be closely watched and guarded to prevent escape or suicide. The second category was mulatto slaves, born into slavery. Mulattoes were the offspring of black mothers and white fathers. The third category was Indian slaves, who were mostly women and children captured by the Yamasee or Creek raiding parties. The fourth was mestizo, offspring of black men and native women, born into slavery. Most slaves labored as field hands or household servants. Slaves required a ticket to leave their plantations. Slave owners were required by law to punish their slaves for disobedience or violations of the law. Slave owners were also required by law to inspect their slave quarters at minimum every 2 weeks for weapons and contraband. Failing to do so would result in hefty fines. Slavery was still somewhat decentralized. Many slave owners allowed their slaves Sundays to work on their own small plots of land to make income. But the practice would be outlawed after the Yamasee War, as the slavery system was becoming more centralized. White and black populations in South Carolina were evenly split, with the remaining 15% of the population consisting of enslaved Indians. Children accounted for more than 41% of the white population, 29% of the black population, and just 21% of the Indian population. And the disparities within genders illustrates two points. First, the Carolina colony was still struggling to attract white women to immigrate from Europe, but they could fill this disparity by importing African female slaves. Second, colonial slavery differed from native traditions. Native traditions in conquest tended to kill all the males and enslave the remaining women and children, meaning the easiest slave to obtain from the natives was the male slaves that they didn't have demand for in their own cultures. The report detailed the recent explosion of their slave population due to the raids in Florida and the establishment of trade partnerships with the Chickasaw and Creek. And they reported that Carolina had received income from selling excess native slaves to the West Indies, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, New York, and Virginia. The census also reported on estimations of neighboring native nations and their populations. First mentioned was Carolina's key ally, the Yamasee Nation, who it was estimated had 500 warriors with settlements 20 miles and 150 miles up the Savannah River from Charleston. Next was the Creek, who they described in Lower and Upper Creek. The Lower Creek lived along the Ocumulgee and Chattahoochee Rivers. The Lower Creek Confederacy's decentralized culture made it quite difficult to estimate any population, so the census did not attempt to do so. The Upper Creek were located along the Coosa, Tallapoosa, and Alabama Rivers. The only nation of the Upper Creek given an estimation of population was the Alabama Nation, 1,300 warriors. The ability to estimate the Alabama Nation was because the Carolina merchants had been trading with them for some years now. West of the Upper Creek Confederacy was the Chickasaw, who it was said had at least 1,300 men and were described as stout, warlike, and not to be trifled with in war. The Chickasaw divided their relations between the English and the French, Louisiana merchants having the advantage of closer geography, but Carolina having the advantage that they could purchase larger numbers of captives. Next were the descriptions of the Cherokee, vague descriptions. Carolina merchants did little trade with them, stating, "The Cherokee has not developed the taste for English trade goods to the same extent as the Creek and Chickasaw." But they were hiding the real issue, that Virginia merchants dominated the trade with the Cherokee Nation, boxing Carolina merchants almost totally from trading with them for slaves or luxury goods. The population of the Cherokee was estimated around 5,000 men, and the Cherokee favored their towns to be located in defensible positions high up in the mountains. By 1707, the proprietors of the Carolina colony had largely withdrawn from colonial affairs, particularly when it came to the Indian relations. So the colonial assembly took a stab at reforming the trade themselves. Their first step was transferring control over the Indian trade from the privateer's chosen governor to the assembly itself. Many of the assemblymen were themselves wealthy plantation owners who found their most profitable activity trading under the table with natives. So changing the laws so that they could openly trade would be a great advantage to them. The established merchant plantation owners feared the recklessness of the newly arriving immigrant merchants, ultimately harming the trade, which could threaten the very plantation system itself. Opposition to the assembly taking control of the Indian trade was due to the history in Virginia, where the assembly quickly doled out Indian contracts based on favoritism, which caused Bacon's revolt. The assembly passed the Act of Regulating Indian Trade and Making It Safe for the Public. Its preamble stated, "Persons trading amongst the Indians in enmity with the government do generally let loose vicious lies to scandal the Christian religion, and do likewise oppress the people amongst whom they live with, by the injustice of their actions, which, if not prevented, may lead to the destruction of the colony." All Indian merchants would have to purchase a license renewable each year for £8. They must also give a £100 bond to ensure good behavior and their obedience to the law. Additionally, merchants were banned from selling ammunition and liquor to natives, and from selling free Indians as slaves. It strictly forbid any act of extorting natives by forcing them to give animal skins, slaves, or other gifts to remain in good standing with the colony of Carolina. The legislation established Carolina commissioners to hear the complaints of natives on any manner in which they were aggrieved by Carolina merchants. The commission appointed Indian agents to police the Indian trade, empowering them to issue fines less than £10 without consulting the commission itself. Although the legislation sounded like it was defending natives, it was once again about who controlled the levers of the native trade. The legislation was also passed in conjunction with other legislation which prevented the free sale of land controlled by the Yamasee. This was because the rich plantation owners coveted the lands controlled by the Yamasee for their rice-growing potential. By only allowing the colonial government to purchase the lands from the Yamasee, they could ensure, through their connections with the assembly, that they were given the first opportunity to pay for those lands themselves. The legislation did open up a forum for native complaints, and a flood of discontent ensued. The Apalachee arrived, contending that their people were sold into slavery, had either been kidnapped or enslaved after they had surrendered to the expedition. Others complained about John Musgrove, an infamous slave trader who would often arrive at native villages and demand that they grow his corn for him or he would come back and enslave them. They complained about another merchant, Jess Crossley, who was accused of, in a rage, beating his interpreter so badly that his interpreter was spitting up blood. Philip Gilliard was accused of forcing a young native woman to marry him. When her mother protested, he viciously beat her in front of her daughter. And these are but a few grievances for the crimes ranging from assault, battery, kidnapping, and enslavement. The goal to regulate Indian merchants' egregious behavior was intertwined with corruption and patronage. Real reform of the native trade would be a constant struggle for the colony of South Carolina. Thank you for listening to this episode of American Political History. If you want to support the show, please subscribe and leave a 5-star rating, and share this show with someone you think would enjoy listening. Thank you again. And until next time.